Paul Moravec's our guest today. Welcome to Crossover, Paul.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I am very excited about your music, and so is everybody else that has heard it. And we are going to talk a little bit about it. But before that, I just want to acknowledge the fact that you will be doing a premiere here in Philadelphia on April 27th. It's a premiere that will be held at the American Philosophical Society. This work is entitled Useful Knowledge, and can you tell us a little bit about how you were inspired to write it?
Well, one of the members of the American Philosophical Society, which of course was founded by Benjamin Franklin in 1743, Glenn Bowersock contacted me, and he said, we're having this tercentenary celebration in 2006, and we would like to commission a composition in observance of it. And he asked me if I'd be interested, and I said, sure. And I immediately had the idea of writing a solo cantata, a sort of soliloquy of Franklin's own words, in which the singer would be Franklin singing his own words with an instrumental group behind him and playing the glass harmonica.
But you've been always interested in time, it seems. This work that you did that was so fascinating, not the one that you've done now, but the Time Gallery, is really a very, very exciting exploration of time, which I guess we're all obsessed with these days. But Franklin was too, wasn't he?
Yeah, if you look at a lot of his maxims that appear in Poor Richard's Almanac, a lot of them are concerned with time, defining it in various ways. He says, for example, one today is worth two tomorrows. You may delay, but time will not. There will be sleeping enough in the grave. Early to bed and early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. Lost time is never found again. You know, he's saying, get cracking.
And, we know a lot of these adages, but they're true. I mean, absolutely true. But music is time. Music is measured time, or has been in the historical sense. Mm-hmm. And contemporary music it is as well, but it's different. And for you to actually crystallize this in a work, which I found in the Time Gallery, mm-hmm. was really amazing. I mean, you use it in various ways. You use the heartbeat at one point. Mm-hmm. You use the ticking of the clock, the chiming of the bells. Mm-hmm. But again, this is man-made measuring of time, isn't it? Except for the heartbeat.
Except for the heartbeat, of course, mm-hmm. which is biological. I think of time as the natural medium of music. So time is the medium of music, and memory is the mediator. So that what music does is to make the passage and the duration and the experience of time audible and sensible in that way.
And very tangible.
And very pleasurably mm-hmm. as well.
Your style is new, but for me, I got some, I don't know, impressionistic vibes from it as well. Really, it's very accessible. I don't want to insult you with that, but it really, really is.
Well, it's a concert work. I mean, it's meant to be performed in concert. And in my view, if you're writing a concert work, it better be understandable. It better be comprehensible by the audience the first time they hear it, because it may be the only time. I mean, it better work in concert. Now, you can write music for other circumstances as well. You can write works for something that doesn't make sense the first time you hear it, and actually may never make sense how many times you hear it. But that's not a concert work. It seems to me that, in my view, that doesn't fit into the category of being a concert work.
Do you think about how the audience accepts it when you compose, or are you inspired on that very high level?
Well, I write for myself as a listener. In other words, I imagine myself in the audience, and I think, okay, I've come to this concert. I've paid whatever the admission price is, if any. But in any event, I took the trouble to come to this concert. Amaze me, and that's what I want to write, and that's what I try to write.
Well, you're also passionate. I mean, there's lyricism in your writing, and intensity and beat measure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the time gallery is in four movements, and in each movement, I treat a different aspect of time and how we measure time. So the first movement is called Bells, and it's basically meant to give a sense of a monastic day at a Benedictine monastery in the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. in which they divided up the hours by sounding bells. So when we talk about a book of hours, for example, that's right. what we're referring to. The Benedictine monks were the first to codify and divide the day up into hours using bells to indicate the divisions. And the second movement is called Time Machine. It's basically a very quick tour in 12 minutes of 700 years of timekeeping devices, mechanical clocks, mm-hmm. beginning in 1300, the use of the pendulum that Galileo introduced in the 1600s. And then the last part of that second movement is a meditation on Newton's clockwork universe, the idea that the universe actually functions like a grand clock. And the last part is called the rhythm of disintegration, because the 20th century scientists come along, such as Einstein, say, well, no, that's not true. That's not how the universe works at all. And the whole thing kind of disintegrates. And that's the history of timekeeping devices and clock thought over 700 years in just that movement.
In just that movement, you really capsulized. However, that's the one thing that we don't have enough of. Yeah. For some reason, everyone complains now that there isn't enough time. It doesn't matter how old you are. Even young people say, there's just not enough time to do everything.
Right.
Why would you think, I mean, why is that? What is it, the perception of time? Do we fill our days with too much? What is it?
Well, I think one factor is the 24/7 entertainment industry.
You think?
Yeah. I mean, that we are so distracted now with so many different avenues of information and entertainment and all these electronic devices. And I think that there's just a lot going on perceptually. And also, a lot of people
are
quite simply working harder than they might have 20 or 30 years ago just to make a living. I mean, look at many people in the middle class working two jobs just to stay afloat, etc.
Paul Moravec is our guest today on Crossover. So here you have the Time Gallery. You won again the Pulitzer for The Tempest Fantasy, and now this new work about Benjamin Franklin will be premiered. What is the group is that's playing it? Is that same La Fenice? Is it Fenice?
La Fenice, yeah.
Yes.
And that's a those are musicians from New York, and it's a group comprising oboe, violin, viola, cello, and piano. And the singer will be Randall Scarlatta, wonderful baritone who lives in Philadelphia, and the glass harmonica will be played by Cecilia Brower, and she plays the celeste with the Metropolitan Opera mm-hmm. Orchestra, and she's a specialist on the harmonica, and she will be bringing her own instrument. She has told me, yes.
The title Useful Knowledge is taken directly from a Franklin opus, right? Isn't that correct? It's something that he wrote, a proposal for promoting
right.
useful knowledge among the British plantations in America.
Yeah, when he was setting up the American Philosophical Society, that's the purpose that he gave for the organization. By the way, when he said American Philosophical Society, he meant philosophical not in the sense of Immanuel Kant, the way that we might mean philosopher, but he was referring more to natural philosophy figures such as Isaac Newton, because scientists in Franklin's day were known as much as scientists, they were known as natural philosophers.
Natural philosophers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that word has changed, or certainly the connotation of it.
The connotations
yeah,
have changed.
Has changed.
Between then and our,
of course,
our
your
day.
Work. Your work is very philosophical. I think you're really you have a message, and you're saying something. Once again, your appeal is quite universal. I think I think you speak a language that is very understandable, and in this world of contemporary music, where there's a lot of criticism about this, the difficulty of comprehending what a composer is trying to say. you really come out very fresh and new. Do you have any opinions about what's happening with contemporary music? It seems to be, for me, going back to a more, not tonal, but again, the word acceptable or comfortable, at least to the ear of the listener. Is that happening?
Well, I hope it's comprehensible. That seems to me a basic, that seems to me a fundamental quality that music should have.
But it doesn't in many cases. Well, the composer does not get it across. Composers who are revered, I mean, it's
I think that that's changed, though. I think that the 20th century is over.
Yes.
In every sense. I mean, and
interesting.
The aesthetic conditions that drove what we call late modernism are basically finished, and they have been for some time. I like to think that, actually I see much evidence of this these days, that composers are writing more comprehensible music generally. And
why?
I don't know. I mean, they just are. And I think that this is a golden age for contemporary music. I think it's the best of times, and it's also the worst of times. We know that it's the worst of times because of financial constraints, and we know it, we know all about that. There's no use in rehearsing that here. But I think that it's the best of times in terms of the standards that exist now for new music. That is, the compositional standards are very high, the performance standards are very high, and the expectations of listeners can be very high. In other words, they hold performers and composers accountable for what they're doing.
So now, this newest work, Useful Knowledge, is having its Philadelphia premiere.
And world premiere.
And world premiere.
And galaxy premiere.
And
galaxy
premiere. And it's subtitled A Franklin Fantasy, is that right?
Right.
And you utilize the words of Benjamin Franklin from various writings, is that right?
Right. This is a fanciful and subjective view of Benjamin Franklin's spiritual life. When I think of Benjamin Franklin, I think of him not so much as a religious man as a spiritual man. In other words, he didn't join a particular organized church in adulthood. He didn't favor one over another. And he didn't speak or write very much about his spiritual life. I think that he felt it was rather private and should be kept so. And so, he did write about it. And so, what I've done is I've cherry picked excerpts from his writings, both public and private, and also from Poor Richard's Almanac.
Yes,
which aren't necessarily his own words. In other words, that was an almanac where he collected,
yes,
and did not attribute authorship to certain things. He just put them in the almanac, you know. But in any event, it's about Franklin's spiritual life. So it describes a kind of spiritual trajectory over 20 minutes or so. It's a kind of soliloquy that does have an emotional and spiritual narrative to it.
When you were researching this, did you get to know him on any particular level? I mean,
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, what kind of a man? So you say he was really a sensitive man. He was a thinking man.
Yeah.
He was a pragmatic person. I think he believed in,
right,
you know, fact.
Well, I think there's been an unfair criticism leveled against Franklin over the centuries, really, about that he was over materialistic. He rejected the spiritual. He rejected the unseen, and so on. I don't believe that's true. I think that there was a kind of devout spirituality underpinning his enormous accomplishment and activity. There was something in him. There's something driving him, and that's one of the quotations that I use in this work, where Franklin says, "To pour forth benefits for the common good is divine."
So he really was. It was to for the good of the people.
Yeah, and I think that this was a. It makes absolute sense to me that this was a deeply held conviction, and his way of serving the divine was to dispel superstition, not to encourage it. It's to dispel misconceptions and ignorance rather than to encourage those things. And in describing in his introduction to explaining how to make a lightning rod, he says, surely the thunder of heaven is no more supernatural than the rain, hail, or sunshine of heaven. It has pleased God in his goodness to mankind at length to discover to them the means of securing their buildings from mischief by thunder and lightning. And then he goes on to describe how to protect your house. Because one of the great superstitions of his time and before that was that if your house was struck by lightning and destroyed, it was an act of God.
Yes.
And Franklin said, well, no, it isn't. It's electricity. I can show you.
Well, the age of reason updated, I guess,
yeah.
Really.
And that's why the lightning rod is quite possibly the most important invention of the 18th century.
Yes.
And made him the most famous American in the rest of the world.
We've been speaking with professor of music and Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Paul Moravec about his past compositions and his newest work, Useful Knowledge, A Personal View of Benjamin Franklin. You're listening to Crossover here on WRTI.